And so she placed 5-year-old Edmund in an orphanage and returned to Spain, where she entered a convent. Edmund had never seen her again. When he was 10, Edmund learned that his mother had died in the convent during a self-imposed religious fast. Overcome with physical pain, she had hanged herself. "It's not a pleasant story," Edmund told Langdon. "As a high school student, I learned these details, and, as you can imagine, my mother's unwavering zealotry has a lot to do with my abhorrence of religion. I call it Newton's third law of child-rearing. For every lunacy, there's an equal and opposite lunacy." After hearing the story, Langdon understood why Edmund had been so full of anger and bitterness when they met during Edmund's freshman year at Harvard. Langdon also marveled that Edmund had never once complained about the rigors of his childhood. Instead, he had declared himself fortunate for the early hardship because it had served as a potent motivation for Edmund to achieve his 2 childhood goals. First, to get out of poverty, and second, to help expose the hypocrisy of the faith he believed destroyed his mother. Success on both counts, Langdon thought sadly, continuing to peruse the apartment's library. As he began scanning a news section of bookshelves, he spotted many titles he recognized, most of them relevant to Edmund's lifelong concerns for the dangers of religion. The God Delusion. God is Not Great. The Portable Atheist, Letter to a Christian Nation, The End of Faith, The God Virus, How Religion Infects Our Lives and Culture. Over the last decade, books advocating rationality over blind faith had sprung up on nonfiction bestseller lists. Langdon had to admit that the cultural shift away from religion had become increasingly visible, even on the Harvard campus. Recently, the Washington Post had run an article on Godlessness at Harvard, reporting that for the first time in the school's 380-year history, the freshman class consisted of more agnostics and atheists than Protestants and Catholics combined. Similarly, across the Western world, anti-religious organizations were sprouting up, pushing back against what they considered the dangers of religious dogma. American Atheists, the Freedom from Religion Foundation, AmericanHumanist.org, the Atheist Alliance International. Langdon had never given these groups much thought until Edmund had told him about the Brights, a global organization that, despite its often misunderstood name, endorsed a naturalistic worldview with no supernatural or mystical elements. The Brights' membership included powerhouse intellectuals like Richard Dawkins, Margaret Downey, and Daniel Dennett. Apparently, the growing army of atheists was now packing some very big guns. Langdon had spotted books by both Dawkins and Dennett only minutes ago while skimming the section of the library devoted to evolution. The Dawkins classic, The Blind Watchmaker, forcefully challenged the teleological notion that human beings, much like complex watches, could exist only if they had a designer. Similarly, one of Dennett's books, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, argued that natural selection alone was sufficient to explain the evolution of life, and that complex biological designs could exist without help from a divine designer. God is not needed for life, Langdon mused, flashing on Edmund's presentation. The question, where do we come from, suddenly rang a bit more forcefully in Langdon's mind. Could that be part of Edmund's discovery? He wondered. The idea that life exists on its own, without a creator? This notion, of course, stood in direct opposition to every major creation story, which made Langdon increasingly curious to know if he might be on the right track. Then again, the idea seemed entirely unprovable. "Robert?" Ambra called behind him. Langdon turned to see that Ambra had completed searching her side of the library and was shaking her head.
"Nothing over here," she said. "All nonfiction. I'll help you look on your side."
"Same here so far," Langdon said. As Ambra crossed to Langdon's side of the library, Winston's voice crackled on the speakerphone.
Ms. Vidal?
Ambra raised Edmund's phone.
Yes?
Both you and Professor Langdon need to see something right away, Winston said. The palace has just made a public statement. Langdon moved quickly toward Ambra, standing close by her side, watching as the tiny screen in her hand began streaming a video. He recognized the plaza in front of Madrid's royal palace, where a uniformed man in handcuffs was being marched roughly into the frame by four Guardia Real agents. The agents turned their prisoner toward the camera as if to disgrace him before the eyes of the world.
Garza?
Ambra exclaimed, sounding stunned.
The head of the Guardia Real is under arrest?
The camera turned now to show a woman in thick glasses who pulled a piece of paper out of a pocket of her pantsuit and prepared to read a statement.
That's Monica Martin, Ambra said. Public relations coordinator. What is going on?
The woman began reading, enunciating every word clearly and distinctly.
The Royal Palace is hereby arresting Commander Diego Garza for his role in the murder of Edmund Kirsch, as well as his attempts to implicate Bishop Valdespino in that crime.
Langdon could feel Ambra stagger slightly beside him as Monica Martin continued reading.
Regarding our future queen, Ambra Vidal,
the PR coordinator said in an ominous tone,
and the American professor, Robert Langdon, I'm afraid I have some deeply disturbing news.
Langdon and Ambra exchanged a startled glance.
The palace has just received confirmation from Ms. Vidal's security detail,
Martin continued,
that Ms. Vidal was taken from the Guggenheim Museum against her will tonight by Robert Langdon. Our Guardia Real are now on full alert, coordinating with local authorities in Barcelona, where it is believed that Robert Langdon is holding Ms. Vidal hostage.
Langdon was speechless.
As this is now formally classified as a hostage situation, the public is urged to assist the authorities by reporting any and all information relating to the whereabouts of Ms. Vidal or Mr. Langdon. The palace has no further comment at this time.
Reporters started screaming questions at Martin, who abruptly turned and marched off toward the palace.
This is madness,
Ambra stammered.
My agent saw me leave the museum willingly.
Langdon stared at the phone, trying to make sense of what he had just witnessed. Despite the torrent of questions now swirling in his mind, he was entirely lucid about one key point. I am in serious danger. Chapter 56.
Robert, I'm so sorry.
Ambra Vidal's dark eyes were wild with fear and guilt.
I have no idea who is behind this false story, but they've just put you at enormous risk.
The future Queen of Spain reached for Edmund's phone.
I'm going to call Monica Martin right now.
Do not call Ms. Martin, Winston's voice chimed from the phone. That is precisely what the palace wants. It's a ploy. They're trying to flush you out, trick you into making contact and revealing your location. Think logically. Your two Guardia agents know you were not kidnapped, and yet they've agreed to help spread this lie and fly to Barcelona to hunt you? Clearly the entire palace is involved in this, and with the commander of the Royal Guard under arrest, these orders must be coming from higher up. Ambra drew a short breath.
Meaning Julian?
An inescapable conclusion, Winston said.
The prince is the only one in the palace who has the authority to arrest Commander Garza.
Ambra closed her eyes for a long moment, and Langdon sensed a wave of melancholy washing over her, as if this seemingly incontrovertible proof of Julian's involvement had just erased her last remaining hope that perhaps her fiancé was an innocent bystander in all of this. This is about Edmund's discovery, Langdon declared. Someone in the palace knows we are trying to show Edmund's video to the world, and they're desperate to stop us. Perhaps they thought their work was finished when they silenced Edmund, Winston added. They didn't realize that there were loose ends. An uncomfortable silence hung between them. Umbra, Langdon said quietly, I obviously don't know your fiancé, but I strongly suspect Bishop Valdespino has Julian's ear in this matter. Remember, Edmund and Valdespino were at odds before the museum event even started. She nodded, looking uncertain.
Either way, you're in danger.
Suddenly they became aware of the faint sound of sirens wailing in the distance. Langdon felt his pulse quicken. We need to find this poem now, he declared, resuming his search of the bookshelves. Launching Edmund's presentation is the key to our safety. If we go public, then whoever is trying to silence us will realize they're too late. True, Winston said, but the local authorities will still be hunting for you as a kidnapper. You won't be safe unless you beat the palace at their own game.
How?
Umbra demanded. Winston continued without hesitation. The palace used the media against you, but that's a knife that cuts both ways. Langdon and Umbra listened as Winston quickly outlined a very simple plan, one that Langdon had to admit would instantly create confusion and chaos among their assailants.
I'll do it,
Umbra readily agreed. Are you sure? Langdon asked her warily. There will be no going back for you.
Robert, she said, I'm the one who got you into this, and now you're in danger. The palace had the gall to use the media as a weapon against you, and now I'm going to turn it around on them.
Fittingly so, Winston added. Those who live by the sword will die by the sword. Langdon did a double take. Did Edmund's computer really just paraphrase Aeschylus? He wondered if it might not be more appropriate to quote Nietzsche. Whoever fights monsters should see to it that in the process he does not become a monster. Before Langdon could protest any further, Umbra was moving down the hall, Edmund's phone in hand.
Find that password, Robert, she called over her shoulder. I'll be right back.
Langdon watched her disappear into a narrow turret whose staircase spiraled up to Casa Milà's notoriously precarious rooftop deck. Be careful, he called after her. Alone now in Edmund's apartment, Langdon peered down the winding snake rib hallway and tried to make sense of what he had seen here. Cases of unusual artifacts, a framed quote proclaiming that God was dead, and a priceless Gauguin that posed the same questions Edmund had asked of the world earlier tonight. Where do we come from? Where are we going? He had found nothing yet that hinted at Edmund's possible answers to these questions. So far, Langdon's search of the library had yielded only one volume that seemed potentially relevant, Unexplained Art, a book of photographs of mysterious man-made structures including Stonehenge, the Easter Island heads, and Nazca's sprawling desert drawings, geoglyphs drawn on such a massive scale that they were discernible only from the air. Not much help, he decided, and resumed his search of the shelves. Outside, the sirens grew louder. Chapter 57
I am not a monster,
Avila declared, exhaling as he relieved himself in a grungy urinal in a deserted rest stop on Highway N-240. At his side, the Uber driver was trembling, apparently too nervous to urinate.
You threatened my family.
And if you behave, Avila replied, I assure you that no harm will come to them. Just take me to Barcelona, drop me off, and we will part as friends. I will return your wallet, forget your home address, and you need never think of me again.
The driver stared straight ahead, his lips quivering.
You are a man of the faith, Avila said. I saw the papal cross on your windshield. And no matter what you think of me, you can find peace in knowing that you are doing the work of God tonight." Avila finished at the urinal. "The Lord works in mysterious ways." Avila stepped back and checked the ceramic pistol tucked into his belt. It was loaded with his lone remaining bullet. He wondered if he'd need to use it tonight. He walked to the sink and ran water into his palms, seeing the tattoo that the regent had directed him to place there in case he was caught. An unnecessary precaution, Avila suspected, now feeling like an untraceable spirit moving through the night. He raised his eyes to the filthy mirror, startled by his appearance. The last time Avila had seen himself, he was wearing full dress whites with a starched collar and a naval cap. Now, having stripped off the top of his uniform, he looked more like a trucker, wearing only his V-neck T-shirt and a baseball cap borrowed from his driver. Ironically, the disheveled man in the mirror reminded Avila of his appearance during his days of drunken self-loathing following the explosion that killed his family. "I was in a bottomless pit." The turning point, he knew, had been the day when his physical therapist, Marco, had tricked him into driving out into the countryside to meet the Pope. Avila would never forget approaching the eerie spires of the Palmarian Church, passing through their towering security gates, and entering the cathedral partway through the morning mass, where throngs of worshippers were kneeling in prayer. The sanctuary was lit only by natural light from high stained glass windows, and the air smelled heavily of incense. When Avila saw the gilded altars and burnished wood pews, he realized that the rumors of the Palmarian's massive wealth were true. This church was as beautiful as any cathedral Avila had ever seen, and yet he knew that this Catholic church was unlike any other. The Palmarians are the sworn enemy of the Vatican. Standing with Marco at the rear of the cathedral, Avila gazed out over the congregation and wondered how this sect could have thrived after blatantly flaunting its opposition to Rome. Apparently, the Palmarians' denunciation of the Vatican's growing liberalism had struck a chord with believers who craved a more conservative interpretation of the faith. Hobbling up the aisle on his crutches, Avila felt like a miserable cripple making a pilgrimage to Lourdes in hopes of a miracle cure. An usher greeted Marco and led the two men to seats that had been cordoned off in the very front row. Nearby parishioners glanced over with curiosity to see who was getting this special treatment. Avila wished Marco had not convinced him to wear his decorated naval uniform. "I thought I was meeting the Pope." Avila sat down and raised his eyes to the main altar where a young parishioner in a suit was doing a reading from a Bible. Avila recognized the passage, the Gospel of Mark. "If you hold anything against anyone," the reader declared, "forgive them, so that your Father in heaven may forgive you your sins." More forgiveness? Avila thought, scowling. He felt like he'd heard this passage 1,000 times from the grief counselors and nuns in the months after the terrorist attack. The reading ended, and the swelling chords of a pipe organ resounded in the sanctuary. The congregants rose in unison, and Avila reluctantly clambered to his feet, wincing in pain. A hidden door behind the altar opened, and a figure appeared, sending a ripple of excitement through the crowd. The man looked to be in his 50s, upright and regal, with a graceful stature and a compelling gaze. He wore a white cassock, a golden tippet, an embroidered sash, and a bejeweled papal Preziosa mitre. He advanced with his arms outstretched to the congregation, seeming to hover as he moved toward the center of the altar. "There he is," Marco whispered excitedly. "Pope Innocent the 14th." "He calls himself Pope Innocent the 14th?" The Palmarians, Avila knew, recognized the legitimacy of every pope up to Paul VI, who died in 1978. "We're just in time," Marco said. "He's about to deliver his homily." The Pope moved toward the center of the raised altar,
bypassing the formal pulpit and stepping down so that he stood at the same level as his parishioners. He adjusted his lavalier microphone, held out his hands, and smiled warmly.
"Good morning,"
he intoned in a whisper. The congregation boomed in response. "Good morning." The Pope continued moving away from the altar, closer to his congregation.
"We have just heard a reading from the Gospel of Mark," he began, "a passage I chose personally because this morning I would like to talk about forgiveness."
The Pope drifted over to Avila and stopped in the aisle beside him, only inches away. He never once looked down. Avila glanced uneasily at Marco, who gave him an excited nod.
"We all struggle with forgiveness," the Pope said to the congregation, "and that is because there are times when the trespasses against us seem to be unforgivable. When someone kills innocent people in an act of pure hatred, should we do as some churches will teach us, and turn the other cheek?"
The room fell deathly silent, and the Pope lowered his voice even further.
"When an anti-Christian extremist sets off a bomb during morning mass in the Cathedral of Seville, and that bomb kills innocent mothers and children, how can we be expected to forgive? Bombing is an act of war, a war not just against Catholics, a war not just against Christians, but a war against goodness, against God himself."
Avila closed his eyes, trying to repress the horrific memories of that morning and all the rage and misery still churning in his heart. As his anger swelled, Avila suddenly felt the Pope's gentle hand on his shoulder. Avila opened his eyes, but the Pope never looked down at him. Even so, the man's touch felt steady and reassuring.
"Let us not forget our own terror rojo,"
the Pope continued, his hand never leaving Avila's shoulder.
"During our civil war, enemies of God burned Spain's churches and monasteries, murdering more than 6,000 priests and torturing hundreds of nuns, forcing the sisters to swallow their rosary beads before violating them and throwing them down mineshafts to their deaths."
He paused and let his words sink in.
"That kind of hatred does not disappear over time. Instead, it festers, growing stronger, waiting to rise up again like a cancer. My friends, I warn you, evil will swallow us whole if we do not fight force with force. We will never conquer evil if our battle cry is forgiveness."
He is correct, Avila thought, having witnessed firsthand in the military that being soft on misconduct was the best way to guarantee increasing misconduct.
"I believe," the Pope continued, "that in some cases forgiveness can be dangerous. When we forgive evil in the world, we are giving evil permission to grow and spread. When we respond to an act of war with an act of mercy, we are encouraging our enemies to commit further acts of violence. There comes a time when we must do as Jesus did, and forcefully throw over the money tables, shouting, 'This will not stand!'"
"I agree,"
Avila wanted to shout, as the congregation nodded its approval.
"But do we take action?"
the Pope asked.
"Does the Catholic Church in Rome make a stand like Jesus did?"
"No, it doesn't.
Today, we face the darkest evils in the world with nothing more than our ability to forgive, to love, and to be compassionate. And so we allow, no, we encourage the evil to grow. In response to repeated crimes against us, we delicately voice our concerns in politically correct language, reminding each other that an evil person is evil only because of his difficult childhood, or his impoverished life, or his having suffered crimes against his own loved ones. And so his hatred is not his own fault. I say enough. Evil is evil. We have all struggled in life.
The congregation broke into spontaneous applause, something Avila had never witnessed during a Catholic service.
I chose to speak about forgiveness today, the Pope continued, his hand still on Avila's shoulder, because we have a special guest in our midst. I would like to thank Admiral Luis Avila for blessing us with his presence. He is a revered and decorated member of Spain's military, and he has faced unthinkable evil. Like all of us, he has struggled with forgiveness.
Before Avila could protest, the Pope was recounting in vivid detail the struggles of Avila's life, the loss of his family in a terrorist attack, his descent into alcoholism, and finally, his failed suicide attempt. Avila's initial reaction was anger with Marco for betraying a trust, and yet now, hearing his own story told in this way, he felt strangely empowered. It was a public admission that he had hit rock bottom, and somehow, perhaps miraculously, he had survived.
I would suggest to all of you, the Pope said, that God intervened in Admiral Avila's life and saved him for a higher purpose.
With that, the Palmarian Pope Innocent XIV turned and gazed down at Avila for the first time. The man's deep-set eyes seemed to penetrate Avila's soul, and he felt electrified with a kind of strength he had not felt in years.
Admiral Avila, the Pope declared, I believe that the tragic loss you have endured is beyond forgiveness. I believe your ongoing rage, your righteous desire for vengeance, cannot be quelled by turning the other cheek, nor should it be. Your pain will be the catalyst for your own salvation. We are here to support you, to love you, to stand by your side and help transform your anger into a potent force for goodness in the world. Praise be to God.
Praise be to God, the congregation echoed.
Admiral Avila, the Pope continued, staring even more intently into his eyes, what is the motto of the Spanish Armada?
Pro Deo et Patria, Avila replied immediately.
Yes, pro Deo et Patria, for God and country. We are all honored to be in the presence today of a decorated naval officer who has served his country so well.
The Pope paused, leaning forward.
But what about God?
Avila gazed up into the man's piercing eyes and felt suddenly off balance.
Your life is not over, Admiral,
the Pope whispered.
Your work is not done. This is why God saved you. Your sworn mission is only half complete. You have served country, yes, but you have not yet served God.
Avila felt like he had been struck by a bullet.
Peace be with you,
the Pope proclaimed, and also with you, the congregation responded. Avila suddenly found himself swallowed up by a sea of well-wishers in an outpouring of support unlike anything he'd ever experienced. He searched the parishioner's eyes for any trace of the cult-like fanaticism he had feared, but all he saw was optimism, goodwill, and a sincere passion for doing God's work, exactly what Avila realized he had been lacking. From that day on, With the help of Marco and his new group of friends, Avila began his long climb out of the bottomless pit of despair. He returned to his rigorous exercise routine, ate nutritious foods, and, most important, rediscovered his faith. After several months, when his physical therapy was complete, Marco presented Avila with a leather-bound Bible in which he had flagged a dozen or so passages. Avila flipped to a few of them at random. Romans 13:4. For he is a servant of God, the avenger who carries out God's wrath on wrongdoers. Psalm 94:1. O Lord, the God of vengeance, let your glorious justice shine forth. 2 Timothy 2:3. Share in suffering as a good soldier of Christ Jesus.
Remember, Marco had told him with a smile, when evil rears its head in the world, God works through each of us in a different way to exert his will on earth. Forgiveness is not the only path to salvation.
Chapter 58. ConspiracyNet.com. Breaking news. Whoever you are, tell us more. Tonight, the self-proclaimed civilian watchdog MonteAtIglesia.org has submitted a staggering amount of inside information to ConspiracyNet.com. Thank you. Because the data Monte has shared thus far have exhibited such a high level of reliability and inside access, we feel confident in making this very humble request. Monte, whoever you are, if you have any information at all about the content of Kirsch's aborted presentation, please share it. Hashtag where do we come from? Hashtag where are we going? Thank you. All of us here at Conspiracy Net. Chapter 59. As Robert Langdon searched the final few sections of Edmund's library, he felt his hopes fading. Outside, the two-tone police sirens had grown louder and louder before abruptly stopping directly in front of Casa Mila. Through the apartment's tiny portal windows, Langdon could see the flash of spinning police lights. We're trapped in here, he realized. We need that 47-letter password or there will be no way out. Unfortunately, Langdon had yet to see a single book of poems. The shelves in the final section were deeper than the rest and appeared to hold Edmund's collection of large-format art books. As Langdon hurried along the wall, scanning the titles, he saw books that reflected Edmund's passion for the hippest and newest in contemporary art. Serra, Kunz, Hirst, Bruguera, Basquiat, Banksy, Abramovich. The collection stopped abruptly at a series of smaller volumes, and Langdon paused in hopes of finding a book on poetry. Nothing. The books here were commentaries and critiques of abstract art, and Langdon spotted a few titles that Edmund had sent for him to peruse. What are you looking at? Why, your 5-year-old could not have done that. How to Survive Modern Art. I'm still trying to survive it, Langdon thought, quickly moving on. He stepped around another rib and started sifting through the next section. Modern art books, he mused. Even at a glance, Langdon could see that this group was dedicated to an earlier period. At least we're moving back in time, toward art I understand. Langdon's eyes moved quickly along the book spines, taking in biographies and catalogue raisonné of the Impressionists, Cubists, and Surrealists who had stunned the world between 1870 and 1960 by entirely redefining art. Van Gogh, Seurat, Picasso, Munch, Matisse, Magritte, Klimt, Kandinsky, Johns, Hockney, Gauguin, Duchamp, Degas, Chagall, Cézanne, Cassatt, Braque, Arp, Albert. This section terminated at one last architectural rib, and Langdon moved past it, finding himself in the final section of the library. The volumes here appeared to be dedicated to the group of artists that Edmund, in Langdon's presence, liked to call the School of Boring Dead White Guys, essentially anything predating the modernist movement of the mid-19th century. Unlike Edmund, it was here that Langdon felt most at home, surrounded by the old masters. Vermeer, Velázquez, Titian, Tintoretto, Rubens, Rembrandt, Raphael, Poussin, Michelangelo, Lippi, Goya, Giotto, Ghirlandaio, El Greco, Dürer, Da Vinci, Corot, Caravaggio, Botticelli, Bosch. The last few feet of the final shelf were dominated by a large glass cabinet, sealed with a heavy lock. Langdon peered through the glass and saw an ancient-looking leather box inside, a protective casing for a massive antique book. The text on the outside of the box was barely legible, but Langdon could see enough to decrypt the title of the volume inside. My God, he thought, now realizing why this book had been locked away from the hands of visitors. It's probably worth a fortune. Langdon knew there were precious few early editions of this legendary artist's work in existence. I'm not surprised Edmund invested in this, he thought, recalling that Edmund had once referred to this British artist as the only pre-modern with any imagination. Langdon disagreed, but he could certainly understand Edmund's special affection for this artist. They are both cut from the same cloth. Langdon crouched down and peered through the glass at the box's gilded engraving. The Complete Works of William Blake. William Blake, Langdon mused, the Edmund Kirsch of the 1800s. Blake had been an idiosyncratic genius, a prolific luminary whose painting style was so progressive that some believed he had magically glimpsed the future in his dreams. His symbol-infused religious illustrations depicted angels, demons, Satan, God, mythical creatures, biblical themes, and a pantheon of deities from his own spiritual hallucinations. And just like Kirsch, Blake loved to challenge Christianity. The thought caused Langdon to stand up abruptly. William Blake. He drew a startled breath. Finding Blake among so many other visual artists had caused Langdon to forget one crucial fact about the mystical genius. Blake was not only an artist and illustrator. Blake was a prolific poet. For an instant, Langdon felt his heart begin to race. Much of Blake's poetry espoused revolutionary ideas that meshed perfectly with Edmund's views. In fact, some of Blake's most widely known aphorisms, those in satanic works like The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, could almost have been written by Edmund himself. All religions are one. There is no natural religion. Langdon now recalled Edmund's description of his favorite line of poetry. He told Ambra it was a prophecy. Langdon knew of no poet in history who could be considered more of a prophet than William Blake, who, in the 1790s, had penned two dark and ominous poems. America, a prophecy. Europe, a prophecy. Langdon owned both works, elegant reproductions of Blake's handwritten poems and accompanying illustrations. Langdon peered at the large leather box inside the cabinet. The original editions of Blake's prophecies would have been published as large-format illuminated texts. With a surge of hope, Langdon crouched down in front of the cabinet, sensing the leather box might very well contain what he and Ambra had come here to find, a poem that contained a prophetic 47-character line. The only question now was whether Edmund had somehow marked his favorite passage. Langdon reached out and pulled the cabinet handle. Locked. He glanced toward the spiral staircase, wondering whether he should simply dash upstairs and ask Winston to run a search on all of William Blake's poetry. The sound of sirens had been replaced by the distant thrum of helicopter blades and voices yelling in the stairwell outside Edmund's door. They're here. Langdon eyed the cabinet and noted the faint greenish tint of modern museum-grade UV glass. He whipped off his jacket, held it over the glass, turned his body, and without hesitation rammed his elbow into the pane. With a muffled crunch, the cabinet door shattered. Carefully, Langdon reached through the jagged shards, unlocking the door. Then he swung the door open and gently lifted out the leather box. Even before Langdon set the box on the floor, he could tell that something was wrong. It's not heavy enough. Blake's complete works seemed to weigh almost nothing. Langdon set down the box and carefully raised the lid. Just as he feared. Empty. He exhaled, staring into the vacant container. Where the hell is Edmund's book? He was about to close the box when Langdon noticed something unexpected taped to the inside of the lid, an elegantly embossed ivory note card. Langdon read the text on the card. Then, in utter disbelief, he read it again. Seconds later, he was racing up the spiral staircase toward the roof. At that instant, on the second floor of Madrid's royal palace, Director of Electronic Security, Suresh Bala, was moving quietly through Prince Julian's private apartment. After locating the digital wall safe, he entered the master override code that was kept for emergencies. The safe popped open. Inside, Suresh saw two phones, a secure palace-issued smartphone that belonged to Prince Julian, and an iPhone that, he deduced, in all likelihood, was the property of Bishop Valdespino. He grabbed the iPhone. Am I really doing this? Again, he pictured the message from monte@iglesia.org. I hacked Valdespino's texts. He has dangerous secrets. The palace should access his SMS records now. Suresh wondered what secrets the bishop's texts could possibly reveal, and why the informant had decided to give the royal palace a heads up. Perhaps the informant is trying to protect the palace from collateral damage? All Suresh knew was that if there was information that was of danger to the royal family, it was his job to access it. He had already considered obtaining an emergency subpoena, but the PR risks and the delay made it impractical. Fortunately, Suresh had far more discreet and expedient methods at his disposal. Holding Valdespino's phone, he pressed the home button and the screen lit up. Locked, with a password. No problem. "Hey, Siri," Suresh said, holding the phone to his mouth. "What time is it?" Still in locked mode, the phone displayed a clock. On this clock screen, Suresh ran through a series of simple commands, creating a new time zone for the clock, asking to share the time zone via SMS, adding a photo, and then, rather than trying to send the text, hitting the home button. Click. The phone unlocked. This simple hack compliments of YouTube, Suresh thought, amused that iPhone users believed their password offered them any privacy at all. Now, with full access to Valdespino's phone, Suresh opened the iMessage app, fully anticipating that he would have to restore Valdespino's deleted texts by tricking the iCloud backup into rebuilding the catalog. Sure enough, he found the bishop's text history entirely empty. Except for one message, he realized. Seeing a lone inbound text that had arrived a couple of hours ago from a blocked number. Suresh clicked open the text and read the three-line message. For a moment, he thought he was hallucinating. This can't be true. Suresh read the message again. The text was absolute proof of Valdespino's involvement in acts of unthinkable treachery and deceit. Not to mention arrogance, Suresh thought, stunned that the old cleric would feel so invulnerable as to communicate a message like this electronically. If this text goes public... Suresh shuddered at the possibility and immediately ran downstairs to find Monica Martin. Chapter 60. As the EC-145 helicopter streaked in low over the city, Agent Diaz stared down at the sprawl of lights beneath him. Despite the late hour, he could see the flicker of televisions and computers in the majority of apartment windows, painting the city with a faint blue haze. The whole world is watching. It made him nervous. He could feel this night spiraling wildly out of control, and he feared this growing crisis was headed for a disturbing conclusion. In front of him, Agent Fonseca shouted and pointed into the distance directly ahead. Diaz nodded, spotting their target at once. Hard to miss,